Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Nelson Ebaugh, who has his own firm in Houston. Nelson, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
If you would, maybe just spend a few minutes, kind of talk about your background, your path to the law, and kind of what you do now.
Sure. Well, I graduated from University of Texas in 1991, and I first worked on Capitol Hill for the Republican Study Committee. It was a fascinating experience, and that's when I decided I wanted to look into law school. I enrolled in University of Tulsa Law School in 1995, loved it. I'm one of the few people that went to law school that really enjoyed the experience. And then afterwards, I worked an assistant district attorney in Collin County. I really enjoyed that, but I also wanted to get involved with business litigation. So I worked for a couple of years with a business litigation firm in Addison, near Dallas. And then I earned my Master's of Law in Securities and Financial Regulation in Washington, D.C. I really enjoyed that too. And the best part about it, perhaps, is that's where I met my wonderful wife. She's also a lawyer, and she was earning her Master's in Securities and Financial Regulation at the same time. By coincidence, we both happened to be from Houston. So after we finished the program, we moved back to Houston. I worked for a firm here in Houston for about 5 years, doing business litigation. And then I decided to hang my own shingle. And I've been doing that for about 15 years. I do a mix of both business litigation and criminal appeals. Amongst the business litigation cases that I handle, I do a lot of securities litigation and securities arbitration. And it's through that work that I became interested in how cryptocurrencies and the law work together. And so that's what brings me here.
And I appreciate that. You know, we were so glad when you reached out to kind of talk about cryptocurrency, because Todd and I, before we started recording, have both admitted we're definitely novices in that area. I think everything that we know, we learned from our friends, Karen Delaney and Jennifer Judge's podcast, Lawyers Behaving Badly. They did a deep dive on crypto and FTX for the first couple of episodes. So if you wouldn't mind spending a few minutes breaking down crypto and blockchain and simplifying it for guys like Todd and me who don't really understand what it is.
Sure. Yeah, it'd be my pleasure. I had a steep learning curve when I was first presented with a cryptocurrency fact pattern. But the more I learned about it, the more I found out that the concepts are pretty easy for a lawyer to get their arms around. You keep on hearing about blockchain, and at first blockchain sounds very mysterious, but it's actually a very simple concept. It's just a method of record keeping. I think a good analogy is, for instance, the real estate records. Of course, they're all recorded here in Harris County for Houston. And that's a very detailed record of all the real estate transactions in the county. But it's centralized. In other words, it's all in one place. The way blockchain is different is, imagine if you have over 10,000 copies of the Harris County deed records spread out across the world. That's what the blockchain is like. In other words, instead of having all the records in one spot, you have them spread out throughout the whole world, and all the 10,000 people that have that record, they have to agree that they all have an exact copy of the other 9,999 copies that are out there. So that's one way to describe a blockchain. Another way to describe it is like an Excel spreadsheet that over 10,000 people have the same copy of, and they all agree that their over 10,000 copies are exactly the same. The reason that the system was developed was to get away from the centralized record keeping system that you have, like with deed records, or actually more specifically banks. You know, we're all familiar with how our banks keep track of all of our assets and liabilities. And so I hope that kind of gives you a general idea about what a blockchain is. In cryptocurrencies, then each cryptocurrency transaction is recorded on this blockchain. In other words, these over 10,000 different ledgers. And as long as everybody agrees on the accuracy of all of them, theoretically, you have a system where you can exchange cryptocurrencies here and there. I can elaborate a little bit more about why this system came into existence. I think that will help put it in perspective. Would you like me to do so?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I absolutely would. The whole thing makes me think about, it's kind of like a common server, as it were. I mean, with people have access to the same bits of information and can make changes within that environment, if I'm understanding.
Yeah, with one caveat, one of the big buzzwords in blockchain and cryptocurrency is that the blockchain is immutable. In other words, it can't be changed unless everybody agrees it's changed.
I'm sorry, I was going to ask about that, is how changes are made if you have 10,000 copies of it and everyone has to agree.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, let me back up a step and I'll talk about how cryptocurrency came into existence in the first place, because it's a fascinating story. In 2008, of course, we remember the financial crisis. And when that occurred, there were a lot of bank bailouts. And understandably, quite a few people were very upset about all these banks being bailed out. They were very frustrated and trying to think of alternatives. And the people that came up with the idea of cryptocurrency, they're very libertarian. They don't like centralized institutions like big banks. They don't like government. And so they wanted to come up with a system that actually got rid of the middleman, like banks, like big banks. That's the whole thrust of cryptocurrency. And what's interesting about it is that cryptocurrency is almost like a religion. It's absolutely fascinating to see these cryptocurrency proponents talk about the system and what it's about. It's like a religion or a political movement, this whole idea of cryptocurrency. They cannot stand big government or big banks. And so having this distributed ledger system is very appealing to them, because then they don't have to rely on a fiduciary like a bank in order to have transactions conducted. So anyway, again, back up to 2008, this is where the story gets really interesting. The person or people that invented cryptocurrency, we don't know who they are. It's an anonymous group that goes under the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto. So Satoshi Nakamoto, that's probably not a real person. They've tried to identify who Satoshi Nakamoto is without any success. But anyway, this person named Satoshi Nakamoto came up with this new alternative financial system. And he did so by publishing a white paper that he spread amongst people on the internet. And people on the internet that really liked it decided they would help Satoshi Nakamoto create this cryptocurrency system and blockchain by using the cryptocurrency called Bitcoin. Bitcoin's the very first cryptocurrency in existence. And I love this explanation of what cryptocurrency has been all about. 2008. They've described it as, at first, kind of an anarchist project, like what I've just been talking to you about it. And then it kind of morphed into a get-rich scheme. And now it's morphed into a solution in search of a problem to solve. So that's a brief, quick history of cryptocurrency since 2008.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
That's interesting. So kind of getting back to it, how does it work technologically or practically that if someone wants to make a new transaction on the ledger, you need to get all the people to agree to that? How does that work?
My thinking is, what's the dispute resolution system?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Now, mind you, I have a bachelor's degree in economics. I feel like I can approach that part of it, but I do not have any education in computer science. To be honest with you, I can't tell you exactly how technically it works, but I can explain the general concept to you.
That's really what we want. If you went to computer science, we'd probably go over our heads too. So that's completely fine.
There's a verification process. Have you guys ever heard of these miners with cryptocurrency? And tell me, what have you heard about the miners?
Generally, that's kind of a thing that they do. I know Texas has kind of had a bunch of people come in and set up Bitcoin mining operations to uncover the new Bitcoins and do the, you know, set up all the computers and everything, run through the process to find the new Bitcoins. Am I saying that correctly, generally?
Right. Explain a little bit further. The miners are essential in the verification process for transactions. So let's say that Nelson is sending one Bitcoin to Jody. I would make that arrangement on my laptop, and then these miners would verify that transaction. And that verification process involves solving very complex problems, math problems. Again, I've hit the limit on how that portion of it works. They compete against each other, and whoever can verify the transactions first and solve these problems that are part of the system, they actually earn a reward of Bitcoin. There's an incentive there. So what's interesting about this system is that, let's contrast it with your normal bank account. I have a bank account at Chase, and Chase is a fiduciary that watches over my money and makes sure that the transactions I engage in are accurate. Well, let's switch back to the blockchain and cryptocurrency system. In the blockchain and cryptocurrency system, you don't have a centralized record keeping group or entity. Instead, it's all these thousands and thousands and thousands of miners that maintain the blockchain. Yeah, so you have these thousands and thousands of miners. They verify these transactions. And if they're the first to do so, like I said, they get a reward and get paid a certain amount of Bitcoin. Jody, like you said, it's fascinating. There's a lot of miners which have migrated to Texas over the past few years. And the reason for that is because energy is so cheap here. You've probably heard about in the news about how mining is very energy intensive.
Right.
That's why they're here in Texas, because it's cheap, cheap energy for them to verify all these transactions.
How are the miners set up? I mean, are these guys in the basement, the usual hacker types? Are these legit companies that are coming in and setting themselves up and taking advantage of our general business friendly climate aside from low energy cost?
They're legitimate companies. And actually, I think in order to be a successful miner, you've got to have an enormous operation going on. For instance, there's a little town only about an hour's drive from Austin called Rockdale. There used to be an Alcoa aluminum plant there. Apparently, they went out of the aluminum business and they've converted it into an enormous mining facility. And the reason they chose that location is because when it was owned by Alcoa, Alcoa had already hooked it up with a lot of electricity from power lines. And so it provided a really good infrastructure for this miner to operate under. But these mining shops can be absolutely enormous and require a large investment in order to get going. I mean, I have heard about some of these small-time miners that maybe just have a laptop running in their basement, like you just referred to. But I don't think that they're the what's keeping this whole system together for the most part.
Well, it just seems like there just has to be a really large scale of operation to make it work efficiently and to have any prospect of earning the reward, so to speak.
That's right.
And interestingly, the city of Fort Worth last year got into the Bitcoin mining business on a small scale. I don't know if they were gifted or they bought some mining machines, but they set them up. And so I think still my city's actually in the Bitcoin mining business to a small extent.
I remember hearing about that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
I'm going to ask another question. You know, we're hearing a lot also, aside from Bitcoin and blockchain, in the news about artificial intelligence. And I wonder, how does the sort of emergence of AI's player in the legal industry impact the Bitcoin mining business?
Well, that's a good question. And my answer is, I have no idea. But this whole generative AI hype that we've been hearing about over the past 12 months, that's an absolutely fascinating topic too. I will tell you, again, not a computer scientist, not even close to it. What I thought was really interesting about these machines that these miners use to verify these transactions, apparently they rely heavily on these video game computers. Video games require an enormous amount of horsepower in order to process all the graphics and the like. And apparently that's the best thing you can use when you're trying to solve these complex mathematical problems in order to verify the transactions on the blockchain.
Well, let's switch over a little bit. I can imagine with this only really coming online in the last 15 years or so, it was probably very unregulated for most of its lifetime. But it looks like, kind of from reading an article that you sent us that you did recently, there's some places that are dipping their toes into regulation, particularly Texas. So kind of how has regulation developed for Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency, I guess, in that regard?
That's a great question. It's still very much the wild, wild west. Although there's, I think that's a pretty accurate description that they dip their toes into regulation. That's all the regulators have done. And it's understandable. I mean, cryptocurrencies are like a strange new fruit. Lawmakers and regulators, they just don't know exactly what to do with it.
What have we seen in Texas in terms of starting maybe to regulate or at least thinking about regulating cryptocurrencies? Or have they? I mean, I guess there's probably some legal implications on whether or not they actually can too.
Yeah, there is a Texas Blockchain Council here in Texas that's based in Austin. They're a lobbying group that's trying to guide the development of laws in Texas, blockchain and cryptocurrency. And they have proposed some legislation, and some of it has been passed. 2 years ago, the Texas legislature amended the UCC so that you can have a security interest in cryptocurrency. So that's one step. At the same time, the legislature also formed a blockchain working group that was to explore possibilities of encouraging a blockchain development here in Texas and basically encouraging the growth of that ecosystem.
You know, you mentioned securitization. Do you see or have you seen people using these as sort of a securitized asset? And I don't necessarily mean as a security, but just as sort of a backup asset for any other types of transactions? Or is there sort of fluctuating value something that scares people away from that?
Because I do litigation appeals, I haven't gotten involved with the transactional work on that. But I'm sure that they have recorded financing statements where they identify cryptocurrency as a collateral. I have heard, just without getting too much into the regulation yet, I have heard that oftentimes cryptocurrency can be a big issue of all things in family law cases. Say, for instance,
trying to value the asset. Yeah.
Right. For better or worse, it's just the way it is. The majority of cryptocurrency investors are men.
Crypto bros.
Right. And it's not unusual for these crypto bros to be experimenting and dabbling in cryptocurrency. And voila, all of a sudden, maybe they have $700,000 worth of Bitcoin. And if they get divorced, understandably, their ex-spouse wants half of that. And so in family law cases, there have been a lot of CLEs on how to do discovery to find cryptocurrency that a crypto bro has in order to distribute it equitably, you know, upon the divorce.
That brings up a question that I've had about this for as long as I've heard about it, which is, how is it that cryptocurrency is valued? I mean, what sets the market value of, say, a unit of Bitcoin? Because you hear about it just wildly fluctuating. We've seen, I know after, we're going to get into the FTX issues here in a little bit, but I mean, is this just an open market, an unregulated open market that it's worth what it's worth, willing buyer, willing seller, and so forth? Or how is the value determined?
That's a really good question. It's whatever somebody will purchase it from you for. That's how the market is set. Now, mind you, there's a lot of skeptics about cryptocurrency investing. And for some people with very good reputations, for instance, Warren Buffett refers to cryptocurrencies as rat poison squared. He doesn't have much confidence in cryptocurrencies. His colleague, Charlie Munger, he talks about trading cryptocurrencies as trading turds. Yeah.
Not pulling any punches. Either one of those guys.
Right. What's interesting is that those two guys, they think that the underlying technology, blockchain, has a lot of potential and is very worthwhile investigating. But obviously, they have no interest whatsoever in cryptocurrencies themselves.
Well, they made their money the old-fashioned way, both of those guys. It's not really that surprising that they would not fully embrace crypto, but it is interesting that they have commented on the potential worth of blockchain itself.
Right. Their perspective is that the market value is determined by whether you can find a greater fool to buy your Bitcoin. That's their perspective.
This is a very sophisticated analysis going on. Yeah. Can you find somebody who's even dumber than you?
Right.
Apparently something of worth to trade for this Bitcoin.
Going back to market value, the value of cryptocurrencies, specifically Bitcoin and Ether, it is amazing to me how valuable they can be. I mean, for instance, I was just looking this morning at the value of Bitcoin, and one Bitcoin is worth between about $29,000 and $30,000. I mean, to me, that's just incredible. I mean, about 10 years ago, somebody bought a Papa John's pizza for thousands and thousands of Bitcoin. And at the time, they were worth less than a penny. So it's absolutely amazing appreciation over the past decade or so. And I think what's driving it, at least right now, well, before the whole FTX scandal and before Bitcoin really took a nosedive, what was driving the market value of cryptocurrency were celebrity endorsements. I don't know if you remember Matt Damon and his commercial about Fortune Favors the Brave that was on the Super Bowl a little over a year ago.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's also Reese Witherspoon. She was really promoting it and trying to say, we can't let just all these crypto bros make this money. The women have to get a piece of the action too. So you had all these celebrity endorsements. And actually, I think it was about a year and a half ago, one Bitcoin got up to about $60,000.
I remember that.
Well, I think some of the celebrities are maybe regretting those endorsements.
Absolutely.
From what I recall, they're being drug into some of the litigation about the regulation and lack thereof and representations that were made that maybe didn't bear out.
Hey, I know that, for instance, Kim Kardashian, she's already settled a lawsuit by the SEC without admitting or denying liability over cryptocurrency promotion.
Before we move too far off regulation, the follow-up question that I had really related directly to one of your practice areas and whether you've seen any kind of movement on the criminal law side. I mean, we know if in fact crypto does wind up being regulated, you know, the SEC will have its influence, but I don't really see anything just from what I know about blockchain or crypto. Is there an overlay here with criminal law specifically when it comes to those things, crypto and blockchain?
Absolutely. It's a big deal. As I mentioned to you earlier about the distributed ledger system of blockchain, when cryptocurrency was first introduced, it was a criminal's currency. And as I mentioned earlier, cryptocurrency it started kind of as an anarchist project. They're sick and tired of banks. They're sick and tired of government regulation. So they developed this new system. And criminals love it because it's a way for them to exchange value with other criminals without having to deal with money laundering regulations that we have in the United States or in other countries. At least it was for a while. The law is catching up. Money laundering regulations apply quite a bit now in cryptocurrency transactions. And for instance, you may have heard about in the news, the Silk Road dark website. On the Silk, that occurred about, I don't know, almost a decade ago. But the Silk Road was the name of an online merchant that would sell you all sorts of illegal stuff, like illegal narcotics, sell you perhaps illegal guns, anything that was illegal that you wanted to buy, you could buy through this website that was on the dark web. And mind you, I don't even know how to get onto the dark web. Apparently, a lot of people did know how to get onto the dark web. And federal government finally was able to catch up with the operator of the Silk Road and were able to put the kibosh on that. But it's kind of like whack-a-mole. As soon as you catch one criminal operating through the use of cryptocurrency, other people pop up. I'll give you an example. I was at the Baylor Law School about a month ago, visiting with some of the law students there. And one of the law students was telling me that he had a lot of friends in college were buying fake IDs and paying for them with cryptocurrency. And the reason that criminals and people trying to do illicit activity like cryptocurrency is that there's perception that it's anonymous and that you can make these transactions under the radar without getting noticed by Treasury Department for illegal payments. But that's starting to change very quickly. The U.S. government and other governments and other entities, they're developing something like a phone book, which identifies who owns what cryptocurrency addresses. If you don't go through an exchange, a cryptocurrency exchange, that's, for instance, an example that is like FTX. If you don't go through a cryptocurrency exchange like FTX or Coinbase, which is the largest exchange here in the United States, you can just keep your cryptocurrency, for instance, well, you manage your cryptocurrency with a private key that nobody else knows the code for. And when you send cryptocurrency, you send it from like a bunch of random numbers, and it's like an email address. So it's like punching a button. Instead of sending an email, you're actually sending cryptocurrency. But nobody knows who that Bitcoin address belongs to until they do. And once the federal government finds out who it belongs to, like I said, they put it in their own record, and voila, now they know that this unintelligible Bitcoin address belongs to such and such person. And once they do that, it's all over for the criminal, because then the government has sophisticated means of tracking these transactions through the blockchain. Remember, like I said, it's kind of like the Harris County deed records, over 10,000 copies spread out across the world, but they're all identical. I mean, that's how the system has to work. They're all identical. And so what the government does is just looks at the blockchain, and they're solving crimes that occurred 7 or 8 years ago using Bitcoin through this sort of analysis. That's a long answer to your short question, how criminal law and cryptocurrency, you know, what's going on there. But it's been a huge deal. Law enforcement has admittedly 10 years ago, they probably didn't know what to make of this, the cryptocurrency and blockchain. But that's not the case anymore. They have very sophisticated means of tracing these Bitcoin transactions and identifying who's involved in these Bitcoin transactions and therefore solving crimes.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. This may be too technical of a question. With them being able to sort of identify specific locations, Bitcoin addresses, is there a way for the government to sort of take possession of these intangible assets for like criminal forfeiture or something, you know, with a traditional criminal forfeiture of, say, a car or cash or even a bank account? It's pretty easy for them to levy that. What about Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies?
Oh, absolutely. But here's the catch. There's two sort of keys. Back it up a little bit and actually put them in layman's terms.
Please.
Yes. You remember how I was using the email analogy? Okay, my email address, for instance, is eballlaw.com. Well, if I wasn't using an exchange and I was just sending some Bitcoin directly to you, Jody, I would have a Bitcoin address and I would get your address. But in order for me to make that transaction, I'd have to use my passcode. It's kind of like whenever you send an email, you have to log into your email account first in order to do it. So in order for me to send Bitcoin to you, Jody, I'd have to log in, so to speak, into my Bitcoin account and then send it to you. So there's two codes or that the government needs. They need to know, for instance, what my Bitcoin address is. And then on top of that, they need to know my password to use that Bitcoin address. And if they have that, for instance, for a criminal that they're investigating, then they're able to do a forfeiture. Now, finding that passcode can be really difficult. Usually the government, they can, through deductive reasoning, figure out what the Bitcoin address might be for a suspect. But then they might have to go search their home and look for the passcode written down, like on a post-it note next to the computer, in order to complete the forfeiture. And that's specific, something very similar to that has recently happened, actually, in a really large forfeiture case. I think they did a search of the home, and they found the password on, like on a piece of paper instead of like a popcorn tin or something like that.
having the password is basically the key, then it sounds like. And
right.
Is that, I mean, how do you even demonstrate to someone else, whether it be a purchaser or really anybody, that, hey, I own 3 Bitcoin? That data is in the blockchain?
Yeah, actually, I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's like having your checking account available for the whole world to see. What's really interesting is that there's what's called, people like us who don't have computer science degrees, we can actually still very easily look at the blockchain and what's going on. You've probably seen the Keanu Reeves movie of The Matrix with all those numbers cascading down the screen.
Classic.
Yeah. When you look at the Blockchain Explorer, you can see every transaction in the world in Bitcoin happening at the same time. And they're kind of cascading down your screen like that. And you do it through what's called a Blockchain Explorer. They have this Blockchain Explorer available for cryptocurrency enthusiasts that want to see what's going on behind the curtain. If you go into this Blockchain Explorer, you can see how much Bitcoin somebody has. I've only done this once or twice. When the Ukraine first got invaded by the Russians, they were accepting donations via cryptocurrency. And a lot of people were donating cryptocurrency. I donated cryptocurrency to the Ukraine just to see if I could follow it through the blockchain. And I was able to do so. It was absolutely fascinating. And when I got to the Ukraine's donation Bitcoin address, you can see how much and when Bitcoin has been donated to their Bitcoin account. All these people that have these Bitcoin addresses, they're just available for the entire world to see. And if you can figure out it's such and such as address, you know exactly how much Bitcoin they have.
And your paper made mention of this, but it's a little bit ironic that really you probably have more of a Fourth Amendment right to your centralized bank account records against the government than you do against your Bitcoin.
Absolutely. Because the blockchain is so transparent, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in it. At least that's what the Fifth Circuit has held.
That makes some sense. If you're putting all your ledger transactions out for the world to see in 10,000 different repositories, then you can't really claim to be privacy interest in that.
No. So what happens if you lose your password? How are passwords, and maybe there's no answer to this, but how are passwords maintained typically?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. Because if you are one of these cryptocurrency purists who's like an anarchist and doesn't want to trust a central organization like a bank, and you do it entirely on your own, if you lose your password, it's all over. That's what I mean by this is, like, again, I'm going back to my Chase bank account. I have a Chase bank account. If I lose my password to go in there and look online, I just go through some sort of verification process and they'll reissue me a new password. But if you're doing these cryptocurrency transactions on your own without the help of an exchange, you've got nobody to help you go get that password. And in fact, when Bitcoin was worth less than a penny over a decade ago, there are some cryptocurrency enthusiasts who collected a whole bunch of Bitcoin. For instance, there's a famous incident where this person in Wales, he collected a lot of Bitcoin. Apparently today, in today's money, they're worth billions of dollars. He threw out his hard drive, ended up in a landfill, and he knows now that they're worth billions of dollars as Bitcoin, but he doesn't have the password to access them. So what he's doing is he's seeking permission from the local landfill to go dig through it to see if he can find his hard drive to get his password.
I might dig through a landfill for billions of dollars.
Yeah, maybe so. Huh.
But actually, this is a good segue into cryptocurrency exchanges and FTX. Okay. Now, if you don't want to take that risk that the guy in Wales had, what you can do, and this is what I've done, by the way, when I've experimented with cryptocurrency transactions, I don't hold my own Bitcoin account. Instead, there's a company called Coinbase that's a cryptocurrency exchange that holds my Bitcoin account. And if I lose my password, I can go back and get it, kind of like I would get it from my Chase banking account. So these exchanges have popped up and they've really filled a need for people that need help with holding onto their Bitcoin account and operating it. They have a very easy computer interface it kind of almost looks like when you get onto Coinbase to do a Bitcoin transaction, it kind of looks like you're getting onto your Chase Online account or to your TD Ameritrade. It's very user-friendly. So anyway, that's why companies like FTX got so large.
Okay, well, we've mentioned FTX a couple of times. Now we understand that that's a Bitcoin exchange. That organization and its CEO have been in the news regularly for the last couple of months. I know from, we've referenced the Lawyers Behaving Badly podcast. I know from, not only did I learn almost everything I know about cryptocurrency and blockchain from listening to Karen and Jennifer, but they had another episode recently where I guess there was a, FTX is in bankruptcy and the trustee has issued a report that does not shine a very favorable light on the company or on its management. This seems to be a lesson in how not to run a business. Can you give us just a quick overview of what went down with FTX and maybe what lessons not only can consumers learn from that experience, but I guess that's really what I would focus on is anyone who's interested in speculating in Bitcoin, what should they be aware of in light of what's going on with FTX?
Well, first of all, this goes back to the whole Wild West situation that we have going on right now. There's not much in the way of regulations of these exchanges. I think the best way to approach it is to tell you what sort of regulations are there right now. In the United States, there are anti-money laundering regulations that apply to these cryptocurrency exchanges. The key principle between preventing money laundering is that these exchanges have to know who their customer is. So for instance, as I mentioned, I have a Coinbase account. When I signed up for that Coinbase account, I had to provide a copy of my driver's license and some other identification to Coinbase. That way they know that the Bitcoin address I'm using, they know for sure it's related to me. And that way, if the government see some fishy activity going on through the Coinbase exchange, it's very easy for the government to get a handle on who's doing those fishy exchanges. Of all the regulation that's out there, I would say that's the most developed in the cryptocurrency ecosystem. And then after that, quickly, it gets very unregulated. For instance, right now, it's very unclear whether these exchanges should be regulated as securities exchanges with the SEC or not. Gary Gensler, the SEC chairman, he says that these exchanges need to come in and register as securities exchanges. The owners of these cryptocurrency exchanges, they're like, this ain't a security operation that we're running. We're not going to register. It's been a big point of contention over the past couple of years. So because there's pretty much only these AML regulations that are being vigorously enforced, catching the fraud that goes on in these exchanges can be tough to do. I mean, that's what the SEC is there for in the first place. The reason that there are so many SEC regulations is to promote transparency. Because it's not clear that these SEC regulations apply to cryptocurrency exchanges, investors just don't have the transparency. And that's why it's hard for them to catch the fraud that's going on, for instance, like with FTX. And so, unfortunately, the SEC has some egg on its face because a lot of people are blaming the SEC for not coming in and making these exchanges disclose more. Again, the whole thrust of the SEC's mission is to put sunshine on these businesses. But right now, there's not sunshine on these cryptocurrency exchanges. And that's why Sam Bankman-Fried can get away with the sort of fraud that he, you know, apparently has gotten away with.
Well, I'm not so sure he's going to get away with it. Yeah. Again.
Sounds like that's still up in the air on that.
Yeah. He's been arrested and is, as I understand it, out on bond right now. I think didn't they extradite him from the Bahamas or someplace?
They did. I'm just being generous and giving him the presumption of innocence.
What about, we've talked about government regulation, we've talked about criminal law. What about just on sort of private civil litigation? Have you seen much impact with Bitcoin on that?
You know, I've seen some of it, not a lot. I've read about it and I've seen some cases on Westlaw about it, and occasionally read about it in the news. I think one of the difficulties with civil litigation is, for instance, a lot of times after you catch up with these fraudsters, there's no money to recover against. And so I think that could be a real stumbling block for plaintiff's attorneys. But only time will tell.
I would imagine that judgment collection could potentially be a lot more difficult too, if you don't have the resources and technology of the federal government, for instance.
I'm envisioning a turnover order, Jody, that says turn over your Bitcoin.
Which is great if you have a physical person that you can put in jail when they don't comply. But
right.
As we kind of wrap up here, number one, I've learned how much I don't know about cryptocurrency and blockchain. It's fascinating. But I'm kind of curious about your personal views as someone who's delved into this world a lot, and maybe implications for lawyers and future implications from cryptocurrency on legal practice.
Two big ones. We've already talked, and those implications are this. I see a lot of lawyers being busy in the securities litigation arena, and I see a lot of lawyers, a lot of prosecutors and criminal defense lawyers being involved in this tracking of cryptocurrency and forfeiture of it. And we've already talked a bit about that, the criminal law aspect of it. But the securities litigation aspect, that's going to be huge. And it's already created a fair amount of litigation. The million-dollar question is, this new strange fruit of cryptocurrency, is it a commodity regulated by the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC? Or is it a security regulated by the SEC? There have been really good arguments, in my opinion, on both sides. And whether it qualifies as a commodity or a security has enormous consequences. It's going to determine whether cryptocurrencies are regulated, again, like I said, by the CFTC or by the SEC. Like commodities, for instance, if you saw the moving trading places, you're familiar that commodities are kind of like bacon, corn, that sort of stuff. So are these cryptocurrencies equivalent to like bacon, gold, or are they investments subject to regulation by the SEC, or are they a little bit of both? And to be honest with you, I've heard really good arguments all around, and these disputes are being played out in the courts right now. In my opinion, what's absolutely fascinating is that about almost a year ago, the SEC brought its first insider trading case. And this cryptocurrency exchange that I've been mentioning a lot, Coinbase, there was an employee at Coinbase who was in charge of marketing, and he had advanced knowledge about which new cryptocurrencies they were going to allow to be traded on the exchange. He shared that information with his brother and a friend. And as soon as it was announced that these cryptocurrencies were going to be traded on the exchange, they shot up in value because all of a sudden they're now available to the American market through Coinbase. But his friend and brother had purchased it like 24 hours beforehand and saw the rewards and went up about $1 million, their investment.
Sounds a lot like insider trading.
That's exactly what the SEC alleged.
Yeah.
But Coinbase was livid about this action. You would think that Coinbase would be happy about the SEC discovering this fraud and doing something about these fraudsters. But Coinbase was very upset because Coinbase was, wait a minute, these cryptocurrencies that we just listed, they're not securities. It's because Coinbase doesn't want to go through the onerous registration process to comply with the SEC laws. That's a huge point of contention that's being played out in many, many disputes. Are these cryptocurrency securities or commodities? And so only time will tell. The appellate lawyers, I think, will be busy for years trying to approach this question on each side. Cryptocurrency lawyers all are well-versed with the SEC versus Howey decision from 1946. It's a really significant, esoteric securities decision that most securities lawyers don't talk about. But in the cryptocurrency arena, all cryptocurrency lawyers know about the SEC versus Howey decision. The SEC versus Howey decision from the 40s, it says that the securities regulations apply not just to stocks and bonds, but also to quote-unquote investment contracts. That's a really broad catch-all. And the SEC says that this broad catch-all of investment contracts applies to this strange new fruit of cryptocurrency.
Sounds like a lot of fertile ground for lawyers somewhere for the next several years, criminal and civil, perhaps.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because all these SEC actions, they're always civil. The SEC doesn't have criminal jurisdiction. And it's also going to be fertile ground in class actions and in individual private securities litigation.
Wow. Well, Nelson, thanks very much for allowing us to spend some time with you talking about this fascinating topic. I do feel like you know, we've joked around. I at least now have a better idea of just how much I don't know still about cryptocurrency and blockchain, but it certainly piqued my interest. We'll link to your paper in our show notes, and we'll also provide a few other resources if we can for folks who are interested in learning more about it. As we've let you know, it's our tradition to have our guests leave us with a tip or a war story, and it really can be about anything you like, but perhaps the context of our discussion today, it'd be beneficial to have something related to the topic if you have something.
Sure, sure. Well, because of attorney-client privilege, I'm not going to talk about any of my clients that have run up against some of these regulations we've talked about. But I'll give you some more details about this insider trading case that I was just telling you about. What's interesting about it is that all the players in this insider trading case involving Coinbase, they all came from Texas. The lawsuit was filed up in the federal court that's in Seattle, Washington. But the founder of Coinbase, who, by the way, is a billionaire now, he earned his bachelor's and master's degree at Rice University here in Houston. He had a dual degrees. He had economics and computer science. And after he graduated from Rice University, he worked for Buenos Aires company, I think doing some sort of like Airbnb sort of stuff. And then he just became interested in cryptocurrency. And voila, he has the largest cryptocurrency exchange in the United States. Like I said, worth over $1 billion. He moved his operations up there to Seattle, Washington, I guess, to be next to all the tech ecosystem up there. And then the people involved in the insider trading, they all went to Texas colleges too. The guy that was working at Coinbase, he went to the University of Texas, graduated from there about 10 years ago. He became friends with somebody else who was at UT's engineering school. So anyway, these Longhorns, and I'm ashamed to say it because I'm a Longhorn too, but these Longhorns, they were at the center of this insider trading case. His name is Sean Waugh. He worked for Coinbase up in Seattle. He's the one that got this information about new cryptocurrencies that were going to be listed for Coinbase, shared it with his UT engineering buddy and his brother. It was investigated because somebody saw some unusual activity on the blockchain. Like I said, you have these people who are just scanning the blockchain for trends and whatnot. They notified Coinbase. Coinbase then notified the authorities. Ishan Wahi, this project manager at Coinbase, he agreed that he was going to cooperate with an internal investigation. But then about 6 hours before he was supposed to meet with this internal investigation team, he was trying to board a one-way flight to India. The authorities arrested him at the airport. And since then, I think he has settled criminal wire fraud charges with the Southern District of New York. So that's my war story about cryptocurrency insider trading. It was an absolutely fascinating case. It's yet to be determined whether the SEC will prevail that these cryptocurrencies they claim are securities are in fact securities.
Well, it really is fascinating. So thank you again for sharing what you've learned with us. And I think our listeners will learn a lot about it as well.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.